Rach, you already know the question.
Yep. Well, I thought I'd try something different today. Let's do something a little different. I want to revisit Star Wars Month like we did a few years ago.
I don't know if I want to do that. That might mean watching the holiday specials again. And,
nothing like that, which shall not be named. No, I want to do a discussion about how I would improve Star Wars if it were up to me.
Oh, no, I'm not sure about this idea.
Hang on. He runs good Star Wars role-playing games and writes these intros. Let's hear him out.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. I'll give him a chance.
Great. Thanks, guys. Okay. So first, let's talk cast. For C-3PO, I want him to be played by Dick Goddard.
What? You mean the Channel 8 weatherman?
Right. The same one from Cleveland.
Who would know him outside of Cleveland? Besides, he's dead.
He is? Oh, okay, fine. Then 3PO and R2 will be played by Big Chuck and Little John of the same TV fame in Cleveland.
That's a bit different.
I can't wait to hear about Luke and Vader.
Ooh, okay, good. I was going to go to them next. Okay, so for Luke, I was thinking of Justin Bieber, but like 2010 Bieber. So we're going to have to go in time somehow. Anyway, at that time, he was still young and innocent enough with spiritual impudence. Vader, on the other hand, can be played by Anthony Hopkins. I picture Vader like an Odin figure teaching a young and innocent Thor after they fight each other for the spiritual power.
This sounds nothing like Star Wars.
Okay, well, but hang on. For Leia, she'll be the mother of Luke, who willed Luke into her womb to combat her oppressive husband. This is like using our spiritual power to overcome great patriarchal evil. Patriarchy is the overall evil and matriarchy is not. That's Leia. She'll be reaching within to pull out the spiritual power to defeat the oppressors in her life. And she'll be taught how to do this by her grandfather Yoda, who's taken on the guru form.
What? Where is this coming from? And what are you on?
Hang on. Han Solo is going to be played by Rian Johnson. He's the half-hate, half-love man, which is the only one who can use the power of equals to guide Luke to his fate on the Death Star. He'll guide Luke to defeat the Odin Vader Allfather and make the Death Star destructive laser into a life-giving projector. It'll be like semen, and instead of destroying planets, it'll make them like an ovum and create life inside the uterus. So a dead world can become alive. It'll be like gestating in the uterus. But Luke, in order to do this, must expand his consciousness. And to do this, he must leave the body and take over the Death Star, which is now the Metatron Geyser. And it seeds love and life throughout the galaxy as Luke's new open consciousness travels the universe, opening the minds of all he contacts.
Rage, there is over a million words in the English language. But I don't think I can put them together to explain how bad your idea is.
Mark? Huh? That is absurd. Have you been possessed by the spirit of Benezi, or have you simply been doing acid and eating wild mushrooms? Why do you think that was an improvement?
Well, Jodorowsky was going to do something like that to Dune, and everyone called him a genius. I just figured if I made a similar pretentious acid trip, everyone would call me a genius.
There's a reason why it wasn't made, Rage.
Yeah, let's talk about that. Sci-Fi Malady, Symptom 177. Jodorowsky's Dune. Better in the byproduct.
Welcome back, sickies, to our, what is turning out to be our final episode of Dune December, at least for the Dune content, anyway. We were originally planning on doing this and then talking about the new Dune by Denis. Unfortunately, that didn't happen because of the fear bug. We're just going to have to wrap it up here on our regularly scheduled program. But just as a heads up, we will, unless Scott suddenly says something different, we will have a final week, but it'll be kind of keeping in our tradition about a reflection of the year and highs, lows, what we are going to be doing next year, that sort of thing. That sound about right, Scott?
Yeah. Hey, let me just tell you, lows for 2020, 2020.
The whole year. More or less. So let's start, of course, with Jodorowsky's Dune. So this really wasn't a movie made. It was more a documentary we watched about the film that he was trying to make but never came to pass. Quick note about Jodorowsky. Alejandro Jodorowsky is a Mexican director that, to my knowledge, has only made 4 movies. At the time of his trying to create Dune, he had only made 3. One of them was, the first one was, I don't know, bikinis eating pudding in the desert. Don't ask me what that was about. And then there was...
Sounds like it was about bikinis eating pudding in the desert.
Well, it was people in the desert grabbing each other. Look, it didn't matter. It was pretentious and stupid. And then you have the Holy Mountain, which is just people writhing around and defecating gold. And
yes,
apparently it was a big hit to some drugged up boomers. And then you had, let's see, El Capo, which is a cowboy movie with his naked child, Jodorowsky's naked child. And yeah, I mean, it is what it was. It's one of those movies where you watch it and you walk out and it fits his view of movies are spiritual and about relationship people, and that's what it should be about. It's like Troll 2, but not fun. Let's just put it that way. So yeah, that's kind of Jodorowsky. It turns out, real quick research here on our end, that he's done a total of 9 films, but at the time of doing working on the Dune prep, this would have been 73, 74, he had only made 4 films. So,
and all of them pretentious artsy stuff.
Oh yeah, totally the stuff that film school students are taught that they should like above all else. So apparently the human condition is only good when it's someone sitting cross-legged and farting on a book of poems for 3 hours while someone in the background screeches on a viola. But anyway, so let me go over the plot that we know of and how it differs from Frank Herbert Dune. And this is going to be short because in the documentary we've watched, there was only a few plot points that were brought up, but they were very different from normal Dune. And incidentally, Jodorowsky, I'll comment what he says concerning his version of Dune, because that's what this really is. It's his version of Dune. First of all, Leto Atreides, Duke Leto, Paul's father, was castrated. Why was he castrated? I don't know. He just was. Maybe that's in the story, maybe not. But in order for him to have a child, Lady Jessica pokes his thumb, takes a drop of blood, inserts it into her vagina, and transmutes it into semen, and that's how Paul is made. So Paul takes on almost a divine birth. He's in a way kind of like David Lynch's Paul Atreides in that he's a messianic figure, which he's a proper messiah, and we see that later on with at the end of the story. And this is the other big difference, more so even than David Lynch's ending of Dune, that Paul is killed at the end. His throat is slit. And then he dies, but his consciousness goes into everybody else in the universe who says, I am Paul. And then Dune becomes a lush green planet that starts traveling around the universe as in hyperspace, trying to seed the universe in peace, love, and whatever spiritual ecstasy it was. Much like I pointed out with the Death Star. That's where I got that idea in the intro.
Yeah, the ending, that was a weird ending he suggested. What the?
Yeah, I don't know what he would. And remember, Jodorowsky made it very clear that he wanted his film, 2 points to be made about this plot. One, he admitted that this was not Frank Herbert Dune. he flat out said, I don't feel like I should have to care about the book. I'm raping him. Just like a man rapes his wife, that's the only way he can have sex with her. It's like, excuse me? So no. You have a very warped sense, okay? And of course, he gets away with it because he's pretentious, I guess. I don't know.
Also, and then, not to mention, other than that comment, he also mentions that when he decided to do Dune, he hadn't even read the book yet. He had a friend. Right. He had a friend who said Dune was really good. So he went, I want to make Dune. So he started making Dune, not even knowing what Dune was.
Right.
I mean, he then read the book later, but that means he already had an idea where he wanted to go before he even read the book. And this guy already has some messed up ideas going on in his head. So where he was going with this, when he hadn't even read the source material, who knows? I mean, this is a guy who decided crap out gold was a great idea in a movie. And well, when you read and find out about him, where he actually did commit a rape on film.
Yes, that was the second point I was going to go to. So, right, when he did read the book, he disregarded it anyway. But second, when he says, I want to rape this movie, when you look at El Topo, there's a depiction where he explained how he raped an actress to make a very powerful scene. This is not a creative genius. He's a monster, okay? And you might say, no, he's a monster, period. I don't care what he did. He's a pretentious, cultic monster, in my opinion.
This isn't Hitchcock actually having an actress attacked by real birds without knowing it was going to happen to get a real reaction. The way he describes it in his own words, he should be in jail.
Yeah. Yes, right. And so there's that. Plus, he even said it at the beginning. Well, I wanted people to have an hallucination experience. So in other words, he didn't want to write Dune. And he felt movies are spiritual things. So as soon as he said that, it sounded a lot like the cult leaders I learn about in my podcast. I have another podcast I listen to called Cults. And they sounded like those leaders. So when I read this, when I hear all these things, basically what I hear is a guy that said, I like some of the characters, I like some of the worlds, and I want to make my own psychedelic, rapey movie that's just going to pander to a bunch of drugged out, well, at the time they were younger, but drugged out boomers. And that's all he wanted to do. And when at the end it says that, oh, everyone in Hollywood thought it was perfect, but they can't make it. I think they were giving you lip service, dude. Pretty darn sure. So, and not only that.
I hate defending him. You made me want to have to defend him for a sec. Okay. He did also. I don't want to defend this guy because, yes, he's a creepy, creepy person who literally raped someone. But no. I am saying, I think some of the reason why some of these studios turned him down was his plan was way too ambitious.
Yeah, we're going to get to that, but I think some of them were giving him lip service.
I think some of it was lip service, but I think some of it was also the studios looking at going, this is going to cost us a fortune to try to even make.
That's true. So, but one of the big issues I have with his plot, and Scott, you can verify this, is that in this Jodorowsky's version, Paul is a proper messiah. Whereas in Frank Herbert's Dune, he's trying to warn against a messiah. He's trying to, because Paul goes on and leads a crusade or jihad, whatever you want to call it, that kills billions. And he's essentially trying to make everyone not trust government by becoming the worst tyrant imaginable. And as a way of saying, don't trust government, don't put all your trust in one singular person. amongst all the other things Frank Herbert was trying to teach, it sounds like he was trying to impart that message. And Jodorowsky said, no, I don't want to do that. I want to make my own personal messianic hippie guru messiah.
Yeah, Jodorowsky took the Fremen version of Muad'Dib that you see being developed within the first book and stopped there without going further and seeing what Frank Herbert really ultimately did with the story, which was to show you the dangers of what can happen in a messianic revolution and how the revolution can get out of control. And even the messianic leader loses the ability to control his revolutionaries. And one of the things that Frank even says is that every revolution carries the seeds of its own destruction.
Yeah. Well, the problem being Jodorowsky never actually read the other books. He only read book one after he started the project.
Right.
And he admits it where he's like, yeah, this isn't the true ending of Dune. I decided to create my own Dune, my own story. Like, yeah. By a mile. He definitely obviously didn't respect the source material in some ways.
And I mean, Dune Messiah was out in 69 and Children of Dune was out in 76. So he definitely could have had access to Dune Messiah and have seen where it was going. And he chose not to. And if I'm going to give my honest opinion, I feel like Jodorowsky was just interested in doing Dune because there were a lot of drugs.
You could make a lot of trippy scenes.
Yeah. He wanted to do a movie about drug use and hallucination and expanded consciousness. And what better than Dune, which has at its core the spice melange that expands consciousness and allows human beings to do things that human beings can't do. I mean, if you want to really explore the expansion of human consciousness under the influence of drugs, it's a hell of a franchise to choose.
Right, but he stopped at where it was going, and that's a problem. But he even did that with his creative team, though. Like, there was David Faust was the artist who drew some beautiful pictures of, like, he made a pirate ship of a spice melange leaking out of it. It looks awesome. It's fantastic. It's nothing like what would have been there, but it's fantastic, which I guess we can move on then to the next point. Cast and crew. This is actually one of the stronger points of the film that Jodorowsky, just aside, he pulled together some very creative talent to make this happen.
Supposedly. Okay. Well,
hang on. I mean, you're looking at H.R. Giger, the guy that would go on to pretty much design Alien. Dan O'Banion, who we covered a film by him, he did with John Carpenter, and that is Dark Star. But Dan O'Banion went on to work with H.R. Giger to make Alien.
I'm not disagreeing with those. I was going to say saying supposedly on some of the actors playing some of the roles.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's true. But I mean, some of the, you know, Orson Welles, fantastic, accomplished filmmaker and actor. Salvador Dali, I'm going to give Salvador Dali the biggest compliment he'll have ever received in his life. Salvador Dali is nonsense. That's the biggest compliment I can give to him.
Again, I'm only saying, like, Orson Welles and things like that, the story that Jodorowsky tells of getting these people to play the role.
Oh my gosh.
It's very fantastical to the point where you're like, either this happened or he is lying, because there is no middle ground here where it's like, it's like, no, it's one of two things. There was nothing in the middle.
Way too much of an embellishment.
Yeah. Either he got the guy to play this role or he didn't. There was nothing in between.
Especially like Mick Jagger. I wanted Mick Jagger to play Fade, which, by the way, and note about Fade, there's a little block in there. They show how Fade burns a butterfly and then lights up a blunt. It's like, really? Marijuana usage. He lights up a joint. Anyway, So he wanted Mick Jagger to play Fade. Okay. And of course he was like, how do I get a hold of this guy?
Oh, he shows up at 40.
Yeah, exactly. We happened to be at a party and he happened to be across the room. And I just happened to look and he walked towards me and I said, you have to be in my movie. And he said, yes. Wow. I mean, or when you listen to Dan O'Bannon, when he met Jodorowsky and he talked about how he looked at my eyes and I saw this kaleidoscope acid warp explanation later. And then he went back to normal. Again, all I could think of was, this is a cult. This is a cult. Yes, he's calling it, I'm getting my assembling my warriors, but I don't see this as assembling your warriors. I see this as assembling your followers.
Well, don't forget, he also said how he got Pink Floyd to make the music was he yelled at him for eating hamburgers.
Yeah, because they didn't recognize his genius that he was delivering to them.
So, I mean, this is the stories that you hear from him. It's like, some of it is, yes, it did happen because he did have some of these great artists working for him and making these storyboards and all this. Some of it might have been embellished quite a bit on his side of the story, but I'm just like, some of these actors, and I don't know, but if he did, these are some pretty good casting choices.
Yeah, David Carradine to be Leto, and he decided to take him after David Carradine drank all his vitamin E.
Yeah, oh, now there is one we have to bring this up too.
What?
Paul was going to be his son, who he apparently put through the hell on Earth.
Of martial arts training?
Well, not just martial arts training, but he put him through 2 years at what? I think 12 was when he was did age he was.
Something like that.
He put him through 2 years of 7 days a week, like 8 hours a day, martial arts training. And we're talking heavy core martial arts. And apparently also mental and educational training or whatever. It's like 2 years of child abuse?
That's what it amounts to. That's what it sure sounds like. I mean,
even he admits it. Like, he says, why the hell did I do this to my kid?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like, unless you're sending your kid to war because you live after Judgment Day, what are you doing this for?
Yeah, for a film? What the?
Yeah. And you know what, too? The whole thing about the cast and crew, now that I think about it, you know what it reminds me of? Have you ever seen that movie Walk Hard? The Ballad of Dewey Cox. It's a parody of like a takes Johnny. It's starring I forget the actor's name, but he is supposed to be like Walk Hard, or not Walk Hard, but Walk the Line with Johnny Cash. But it's like a trope of all these different. It's like they take a character that's supposed to be like Johnny Cash. But put him through all these musical genres like punk and Bob Dylan and all that over the years. And it's a parody spoof. But when they get to the 60s, late 60s, early 70s, he's dropping LSD all the time. And he's trying to make this masterful composition. And he wants 1,000 didgeridoos and bells. It have to be church bells from this cathedral. And it has to be this orchestra and a goat. It needs to have a goat. The goat sounds have to sound like, I'm going to die, not, I'm a goat. And that's in the movie, it's made like this guy's just nuttier than a fruitcake. It's funny. Then you look at Jodorowsky and go, this is Jodorowsky. He's Dewey Cox wanting to make the masterful suite. And he's bringing all these elements together, some of which are outright fantastic, but he's just mushing them together and then saying, not good enough. I need more didgeridoos.
Yeah. Now, the interesting thing would have been that we would have had an R-rated Dune if he had made it, though. Because I said the interesting thing being we would have had an R-rated Dune if he made it.
Oh. Without a doubt.
For one, he was going to have Orson Welles float around naked all the time.
Right.
And also, you were going to get a inside shot of a vagina.
And yeah, because that was the when
birth of Paul. Yeah,
Lady Jessica. Yeah,
and yeah, it was going to. And again, that's the only what we saw. There was an entire book he made of what this was going to look like.
Yeah.
And I can only imagine what some of the other scenes were going to be, considering what he's done. Like, yeah, I probably don't want to see some of this.
I'm sure I wouldn't have. When you see some of the costume choices, it's like some of them, like the one they actually made, it looks like a gimp outfit. With sidearms, sidearm ray guns from Buck Rogers. I'm not joking.
When yes, well, it did get used in Buck Rogers. No, not Buck Rogers. Flash.
Flash Gordon. Right, but they give him a gimp mask and make it look like that. And all I could think is, this is not Dune. This is sadomasochism.
Yeah.
But then again, he's on drugs, so why not?
Yeah, I'm just saying it would have been interesting to see, because I've always said Dune probably to be made properly, A, has to be longer and has to have an R rating.
Well, he wanted it to be like 20 hours or whatever.
Well, let me finish what I was going to say. I was going to say I always said that, but then I realized this is what he wanted to do and went, oh, never mind. Maybe a shorter and non-R-rated might be better, because if we want to get that, we can always go with this insane nut job.
Yeah, and that's what he did. But I have to at least say that it's interesting that he was able to get the cast and crew, at least some of the creative types, that would go on to make some wondrous things, which we'll talk about that later. But to me, that was actually a high point, which is why we titled this Better in the Byproduct, because the drawings and the way it encouraged other people to move on really created some of the best stuff in science fiction film.
I agree, and that's what I'm going to actually bring up now, where you went with some of the shots that he was setting up.
Yeah. That zooming out shot, that did look awesome.
I mean, he was planning on zooming in from outside of the galaxy in one continuous shot into, like, which, let's be honest, has been done now. But at the time, how the hell were you supposed to do that shot?
Sounds awesome.
It would have been really ambitious, and it would have been groundbreaking for the time if he could have pulled it off.
Yeah, I mean, he set up some very groundbreaking ideas of shots. Let's put it that way. But the execution of the shot, I don't think he could have done it, especially at the time. I mean, with today's technology, sure. No problem at this point in time. When he tried to make this originally, how on earth was he planning on making some of these shots? Because some of these shots were so ambitious that even today, they would be challenging. Not impossible, challenging.
Right.
Then, I'm saying impossible.
Well, I think we might be getting a window into the... I said in our pre-show conversation that there's a difference between being eccentric or slightly eccentric, and there's one marble rolling around in your brain that has split in half and lit on fire. And I think we're, combined with some of these other things, starting to see where maybe what Jodorowsky doesn't have a great idea of in his head is what he can visualize and what he can actually take to the screen, and how he can actually convey these visions in a way that will translate to an audience accepting the film with mass appeal. There might be a reason that the man didn't work for 21 years in the film industry, aside from what went down in El Topo.
Well, also because he never worked in the film industry. He decided to make a couple of films after coming out of making plays. He made plays and then went, I want to make a film, without knowing anything about film. So he made a few cult classic hippy-dippy films, and some people, you know, loved them. But he didn't know what the first thing of what he was doing or how to make films. So he then goes from making these hippy dippy films to wanting to make this magna opus film that would require insane technical mastery of the craft.
Mm-hmm.
No,
yeah.
Not going to work.
No.
And again, I would agree with you, Scott, because I think I get what you're saying, because he definitely has this split where part of him is coming up with these genius ideas and concepts and these shots that are amazing, impossible to pull off, but amazing. And the other half of his brain going off on some weird trippy acid something where he's like, I want to rape this book. And I want you going, what? I'm sorry, you're both a genius and completely insane.
He's a guy that you want as a consultant to give you ideas, but you don't want to let him drive the car.
No.
And that's the
problem. I don't even know if I want to give him the map, but sure.
I think he's also... So, sometimes you get artists who... They're not really out there about producing a work of art that has a practical value or an aesthetic value. They're out there for the sake of a nebulous concept of art. And the end product isn't the goal, or coming up with something coherent isn't the goal. It's art for the sake of art. And I wonder if some of his problems here is that he's so lost in the theory aspect of making a film that he forgets the practice of it and the ability to pragmatically finish a movie. And I think that when I started watching this documentary, I was intrigued by the potential of what he wanted to explore. And I was captivated by his passion for the project and the story, and how much time he took to begin to understand certain elements, not all, but certain elements of what was going on in Dune. And even though I knew from the first 5 minutes that it was going to be a bastardized version that only was true in certain areas to the story being told, what he wanted to explore had such a passion to it that I felt that it could have been amazing if he was capable of doing everything that he wanted to do and felt that he could do and take what was in that storybook and in those storyboards and put them on a film. There's a lot of thought given to his team, not only his production team and his you know, the people making the film, but the people acting it. And he was thinking of it down to a minute detail. But at the same point in time, it became evident very quickly that he didn't understand the full story and that he didn't really have the ability to move from point A to point B to point C. It was kind of like the Green New Deal. We're going to be fully energy independent by 2030 because we are, and farting cows. And you got to have a plan. You know, it's like the underpants gnomes. Step one, make Dune. Step three, profit. Don't know what step two is, but...
Well, and you know, too, you mentioned that he didn't know what he didn't have a clear path. I think he did, but I think he was so caught up in his own genius and vision that it didn't really matter to him. And he talked about, I'd cut both my arms off to make this film. I will only make it if I can get these people. It shows a person who really was his own worst enemy. And look, Scott, I made a note in the prep notes here that, and you've clearly outdone me here. I said, Scott, it was on the thoughts of what he tried to create. It says, excuse pretentious nonsense spiritual crap because of the passionate pretentious crap. And you've basically just kind of 180'd me and said, yes, he was passionate, but here was a guy that was too wrapped up in his own vision and creative sense of genius and sense of self-worth and everything else. He didn't quite stop to go, am I making something feasible and good here? And I think that he wanted to create a cinematic version of a cult. I felt that listening to him the first 10 minutes when he talked about spiritual this and spiritual that, all I could picture was this guy wants a cult. He doesn't want to make movies. He wants to make a cult. And he called his warriors his people, and he traveled around and he recruited his disciples and he brought them together. And yeah, he encouraged them, and that's good, but he wanted them to join him on this spiritual quest. And remember what Dan O'Banion said? I looked at his eyes and I saw this vision, and then he took me back to normal. It's like, this is not the actions of a director who just, everyone says, man, I want to be part of that idea.
Yeah, that was so bizarre. It's like, I got the special marijuana, and then somehow he timed it at the right point to force him to hallucinate, and then on command stopped him having an acid trip. That sounds like someone whose mind has been warped after the fact and has a false memory implanted. I don't know. There's a lot of... I can understand why the studio wouldn't let him direct it. Because ultimately, yeah. I wouldn't have faith of him bringing a major budget film. I mean, he's a guy who was in the Chicago underground cinema. You know, he's in their Hall of Fame and Lifetime Achievement Award. You know, it's a big difference being a guy who can put together a small budget film that is expected to be weird and wacky and bizarre, as compared to a guy who's got to make a big budget film that has been, shall we say, sanitized and smoothed over for mass consumption. Because if you're going to get a film out there for mass consumption, you know, let's say that, you know, what this guy's trying, what he thinks he is Quentin Tarantino. And if you're going to be Quentin Tarantino and you're going to make a film for mass production, Kill Bill and From Dusk Till Dawn is about as crazy as you can get without bringing it back some, maybe even Inglourious Basterds. But if you go much farther than From Dusk Till Dawn, you can't have that film out there for mass consumption.
Well, I'm just going to say this, and... okay, about halfway through the film, or this documentary, I should say, my mindset changed. The first half and the first 10 minutes or whatever, when he's talking about spiritual warriors and movies are spiritual, and I was scared. I'm like, oh, great. But then seeing the concept arts and all this stuff and how he's talking about this, I'm like, this would be an interesting film. I kind of would like to have seen this made. Then the second half of this documentary went on, and he went completely nutso.
Yeah.
And everything he was saying, I'm like, I don't want to see this film. This film would have been a disaster.
Yeah.
If this film would have been made, I probably would want to watch it because it's not my Dune. I would have wanted to see it because it's like, what? It would have been more of the thing of seeing it for the disaster it was than the masterpiece it was.
Yeah, it would have made David Lynch's Dune look like a masterpiece.
Yeah,
Yes.
I think part of the problem, too, if you're looking at it from him, Scott, you were talking about big budget and what people would get out of it. For all you know, though, that would skyrocket because he decided to erase half the production because Mick Jagger farted on set instead of burped, releasing the wrong kind of chi onto the set. And therefore, Orson Welles can't eat properly and float around, and his dong is going to turn left instead of right. And that ruins the flow of the whole scene. You know what I mean? For all we know, he's the kind of guy that would do that. Or one little scene is off, and instead of just reshooting that one scene, erase the whole thing and we start again.
I feel like he's the type of guy who might spend 45 minutes having you park the Big Bertha.
Yes. But you got to do it. Unlike that, which was just mundane and wrapped up in his own world building, this guy would do it because you weren't doing it spiritually enough. Whatever that means. So I think I agree with Thomas. I'm glad this didn't get made. I think it would not have been as good as David Lynch. And that one was awful. So, but now that we kind of got our own takes out of it. I think we could talk about what we did like, though. From seeing this, was there anything you liked? So we ripped on it quite a bit. But I can say what I did like is the concept art, at least of the vehicles. The ships looked good. Normally, I like H.R. Giger's work, but I couldn't stand Harkonnen Castle because it was just grotesque for the sake of it. And the way to fly into Harkonnen Castle was for him to open his mouth and for the castle to open its mouth and swallow the ship just like Baron Harkonnen would. Didn't do it for me as much as I like H.R. Giger. But I did like the concept art a lot. I won't lie.
The concept art was a big thing for me, agreed. And the concept shots, let's put it that way.
Oh, yeah, especially that, yeah, the zoom at the beginning for sure.
Right. Some of these concept shots were just amazing. And some of the concept arts. I mean, the flying craft around on the planet.
Mm-hmm.
That looked pretty good.
Yeah.
Like, I'm like, that makes sense. That seems like a good idea. I can't really have anything against that.
Yeah, the Ornithopter looked okay.
Some of the spacecraft looked good. And Harkonnen Castle, I didn't have as much of a problem with. I would agree the opening the mouth thing was a little... I'm sorry, what? No thanks.
Yeah.
But some of it, and some of the costume designs, and some of the, I guess, concept work that was done, sure. But I just don't know. Some of the concept art was also weird. So I
for sure
don't know. And maybe also the one shot of all these women or whatever riding the one sand dune, the sand worm. That one also looked...
Yeah, that looked cool.
It looked interesting. Like, interesting.
I think you have potentially an amazing comic book or anime adaptation of Dune if you can just get him to not kill Paul and then do the I am Paul, I am Muad'Dib, I am Muad'Dib, I am Muad'Dib. You can take that insanity out of there. You probably have a potential using that storyboard book to create a fantastic anime or comic book adaptation of Dune with some story editing. I don't want to see it made because I don't want to see Joe Dworsky make another dollar off anything for the rest of his life. But I think what did I like about it? The passion. I think the passion and the creativity that he brought to it could have came with a very interesting story if someone could have made sure it got to the screen in a way that started and ended. And I'm not sure he was capable of doing that. I guess he did write a script and it was there, but who knows if it could have ever got through production. I also, like, one of the concepts I liked was coming up with a different band for every different main group and character and planet, which might have made a very interesting soundtrack. I'm not sure that when I think of the Atreides, I think of Pink Floyd. I really like Pink Floyd, but I don't know about that. The band that he picked for the Harkonnen planet sounded about right. But I guess what I really liked was his this can sound crazy, the passion and the ability to really get into the minutiae, to make sure that he had the minutiae right to world build. I think he could have made an amazing visualized Dune universe. And I think all of that time that went into it would have got us an amazing visual film, very much J.J. Abrams-esque. I think the story that came out of it would have started out intriguing, again, J.J. Abrams-esque, and then had too many juggling balls, so to speak, to bring it to any type of coherent conclusion. And I think it would have crashed and burned worse than the Millennium Falcon in Episode 9.
See, I agree with you, Scott, because the passion was what was intriguing, because you're listening to this guy and you're like, wow, he really wants to make this film and he really has a mindset and he really has an idea of what he wants this film to look like down to every little detail.
And add the eccentricity into it, and I'm really intrigued because I do believe that your best artists and your best creators are going to be somewhat eccentric. They're not going to be normal. They're going to be abnormal to a degree.
What's the saying? The insanity and genius is two sides of the coin?
Yeah. So, I mean,
something like that.
I don't know if you have to be insane to be a genius, but, you know, you get to that walking to your own drum and just slightly out of line. You know, I mean, like Wes Craven. Wes Craven's a little out there. He's a little off. He's a little different. He's writing his nightmares. Quentin Tarantino, as I said before, is a lot off. Stephen King is not normal. And these guys have created, they're some of the best storytellers of a generation. They really are. And you got to have some bit of that abnormalcy to you. But I don't know if, you know, as I said, where do you cross the line between eccentric and crazy, eccentric and nobody's home? And I think Joe Dworsky had crossed that line a long time ago.
Mm-hmm. So as we're getting close to wrap up, I just want to make a quick note about some of the byproducts that did come out of this that are positive. We saw Alien with H.R. Giger and Dan O'Bannon teaming up, the look of the aliens and all that. Star Wars got some. Now, they make a mention that the book, when they made the rounds around Hollywood, it must have, because some of the fight scenes looked, the choreography looked similar in Star Wars. In Indiana Jones, the scene with the Ark, they show how when Paul was dying and his spirit was flying up, they borrowed that image for Indiana Jones. It's possible in Raiders of the Lost Ark. You see in Terminator, the robot vision. There was something supposed to be like that with a training robot versus Paul.
Yeah.
That vision was there. That was neat.
I don't know if some of these I agree with, where he was saying, because at the end there, they were going off and saying what it influenced. Some of them I agree with. Some of them I'm like, I could see it if I was really looking for it. Like Star Wars, the fight scenes. Or it could just be like, I don't know, what Lucas said it was, ninjas and samurai. Because they're fighting very much in a samurai fashion.
That's true. So it's
like, if I'm looking for it, I can find it. But that's where you kind of get into that conspiracy theory where it's like, see, I did this first. Well, did they see it or not? Because apparently there's only two books out there in the universe. And apparently these people saw it.
Yeah, I mean, it is a chicken and an egg argument. So, but we could just, there are certain influences. And like I said, some of the creators, H.R. Giger, Dan O'Bannon, Faust, Mobius, who went on to make some comics. In fact, amongst those comics, I haven't read them personally, but I've been told that the Incal is quite good. And Metabarons was supposedly very much influenced by Dune. I think Incal went on to partially influence The Fifth Element, which is why Jodorowsky was considering suing for that. It didn't work, but, you know, probably because there was also other influences like, what was that? Valerian. So you pick. But so there was some great talent came out of this. So we could at least say that was a bonus, but ultimately it was rejected. And we're going to finish up down to our last two points here. Why was it really rejected despite all this creative talent? And I'd say a couple reasons. One, they make it clear in the documentary that it was because of the director himself. The film companies did not like him. They thought he was odd. And like I said before, for all they knew, he would cancel the whole production and start from the beginning and cost them more money because Mick Jagger farted in the wrong time or farted while he was standing on the wrong constellation circle. So there's that. Two, And I will agree with one thing. One of the speakers in the film said, the documentary said, that film company heads have no business judging the merit of a creative work because they're documentary, they're accountants. And that's what they are. They're accountants, they're business leaders. They are wholly devoid of creativity themselves. So because they themselves are that uncreative, that whenever actual creativity comes along, it scares them because, well, let's face it, if you're an accountant who worked your way up to the top of a film company, at some point someone's going to realize you don't know what you're doing, you don't know what this is about, and my God, I need to surround myself with other mediocre idea people, otherwise I'm going to get usurped. Or I will stay in this position, but they'll sideways me and someone else will ascend. So...
yeah, I don't know well, if I fully agree with you on this. And no, this isn't old. This is an old argument. And we're not going to break any new ground on it today. But I do think that, and this is just an open statement, you're not the most business friendly person, Mark, where there's a value of that. And that's fine. Everyone has their different things on it. But especially when it comes to entertainment, you don't really value the dollar side of the entertainment industry. But these films cost a couple $100 million to make at this point. So you do need to have, like, creators will always look at it. You know, some of these guys, these directors get rewarded with their project where they say, okay, you made us a film that made $900 million in profit, so we're going to let you go do your artsy thing that's probably going to lose money or break even as a reward. But the only reason those films get to be made is because the accountants and the business people figure out how to churn out the things like Avengers Endgame, which make hundreds of millions of dollars. So it is a synergy, and it has to be balanced. It's, you know, let's use COVID as an example. If the doctors had their way with COVID, the whole world would have been shut down entirely for the last 10 months because it wouldn't have been safe to go out. And it had to be balanced by the political leaders who said, well, yes, but we have to have some risk that we do take to keep society functioning, because if we just lock everyone in their house, it'll be, we won't have a remnant of a functioning society. So it does have to be balanced. And you have to balance pure creativity with someone looking at it, remembering that what we're doing here is not it's not pure creativity. The goal of making a movie is to make money for the film company. And sometimes the accountants have to look at it and say, this is a fantastic idea and a fantastic creative idea, but I don't see how, from my perspective of monetizing this thing, that I can make it make money and make it make financial sense. And if I happen to make this film, I'm going to Titanic the studio. And so ultimately, those guys are there for a reason, to look for when the creator says, I have this fantastic creative idea, and they say, yes, you do, but there's no way to not kill the studio with it.
Well, not to mention... It's Jaworski, man. I'm sorry, but if this guy walked, I was a studio exec, and that guy walked into my office, I would be very apprehensive of making his films too. I'm just saying.
I agree.
The guy who his last film had, when you're walking into the studio going, I want to make this film. What was your last film? A guy pooping gold. Before that, I raped a woman on a camera. What?
No, Thomas, I completely agree with you about that. What I was just merely trying to point out is that, in general, I agree with the statement that guy said. And Scott, my two-word rebuttal is Kathleen Kennedy.
Well, yeah, they're not always good. They're not always, look. There's bad. So, there's bad you accountants.
Said, you already said we're not breaking ground, so I just wanted to respond. Yeah,
but they're necessary. I get it. So, but the end result is: had someone else been directing the pitch that Joe Jaworski brought to them, they'd have made the film.
It might have been happening.
They weren't going to let an indie director who didn't have any experience doing something on the size and scope that he was going to do with a major franchise. Or it wasn't a major franchise at the time, but they weren't going to give him. Look, I mean, this would be like me walking into JP Morgan Chase tomorrow and saying, I want to be your CEO.
Scott, Thomas, I agree with you. I'm just saying in general, I would go with that guy. But on this one, there's exceptions. And this is one where I totally agree with that. This is what I'm telling you. This is one reason why they said no. One is because Jodorowsky himself. Yep. And I wouldn't have funded it. I would have said, looks kind of, well, I don't think the vision would have made me want to do it anyway. But certainly when I met that guy, I would have been like, there is no way I'm giving that guy a penny. So, yep. And I think the third reason is that, Scott, you mentioned earlier, the cost. In order to do his vision, I don't think they had the capability. And even if they had, the cost would have been so outrageous for this project that really would only have only appealed to drug users, hippies, and the artist types.
Yep. I'm not sure George Lucas could have pulled it off in 77. And he was doing revolutionary effects. And I using the best technology at the time, I don't think you could have brought those storyboards to life in a way that it needed to be.
And even if you could have, like I said, the cost was such that for the audience it would have reached, you would not have made your money back. You would not have broken even.
No.
So,
no, not even close.
So I think that, in my mind, is why it was really rejected. Some of them might have liked it. Some of them might have just given them lip service, but all of them came to the same conclusion. This nutbag wants to make something that's going to stretch us to our limit. I mean, come on, $100,000 a minute for Dali. And this goes back to another plot difference. They were like, oh, the emperor is only going to be there for 5 minutes. But if I'm an accountant and I'm looking at this guy, heck, no, let's just say I'm a creative type who's in charge at this company, myself. And I'm looking at this. I see, okay, you want to spend $100,000 a minute for Salvador Dali. And you assure me it's only going to be 5 minutes. But knowing you, that could change because you got you had some neurologist tell you that the film would be successful if you added 10 more minutes of Salvador Dali, and you would do it because you're a sucker for that. So that $500,000 just turned into 15. That's a big fat no. And Salvador Dali is nonsense. And for all I know, he might not want to come in one day because Dali. No other reason than Dali. But I still have to pay him for contract. No. Goodbye.
This is the type of film that if you're Steven Spielberg or you're James Cameron and you come to a studio that you have a long-term relationship with and you've said, I've made you dump trucks full of money so that you can build a fortress on the moon if you want to over my career. I want you to greenlight this with an unlimited budget because of everything I've done for you. And they still might say, James, get the hell out of my office.
Yeah.
Let alone if you're Alejandro Jodorowsky.
Yeah. Yeah. And this is the type of film you really should have. If you want to make a film like this and this broad of an idea, you probably should have already made a few films, have some under your belt, especially with a studio that you've worked with multiple times and you have a relationship with. Then you can go, can I please make my love project here? And if you lose money, I've already made you money.
It's like Robert Zemeckis didn't get to do some of the stuff he really wanted to do he didn't get to do Back to the Future until he had done other things.
Right.
Yeah. Back to the Future got shut down because Zemeckis hadn't established. It wasn't until he had made his own name that he was able to go do that film that he wanted to do. And it turned out to be amazing. But sometimes you've got to show people that they can trust you and that you can deliver. And I mean, Jodorowsky has never shown that he can deliver a financial success. So why would or a film? Yes.
Yeah.
Or a film.
I don't think he makes films. He just makes art splatter pieces and goes, there is spiritual. There is relationship. It is genius.
You just made him Russian. Yeah.
I can't do this.
You can't do the Spanish accent, the Spanish-French accent.
Jodorowsky's an East, a Slavic name, so
I think it's good that this film did not get made. It would have been damaging to Dune, and it might have killed the novel franchise.
Yeah.
In the same way that I don't know if anyone is actually going to get the next Game of Thrones novel if George ever writes it because of what HBO did to end that thing.
Yeah. Well, there's also the bit where this would have been, knowing the rest of his works, it would have been so bad that it could have killed the sci-fi movie franchise itself for a while.
You wouldn't have had Star Wars.
No.
They wouldn't have rolled the dice on Star Wars because they would have said, oh, it's another Dune. No way.
Right. And we could have not had Aliens. We could have not had any of the great movies we've had.
If you don't get Star Wars, you don't get Star Trek the Motion Picture. If you don't get the Motion Picture, you don't get the Next Generation. And you don't get next month's Trekking into the New Year.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I have this feeling, and I could be wrong, but my thought is this film get made, the entire genre of sci-fi would have been either destroyed or set back so far that just now we might be getting something in that genre.
It survived Star Crash.
Well, Star Crash wasn't a big budget get out there, and you know what I mean? I don't know, destroyed, but set back, for sure. You would not have had some of the better projects that have encouraged and inspired other things. Like I said, Star Wars or motion picture. None of those things would have happened. We would have been hurting for it. So
this is why I said destroyed, because I think it might have been destroyed because we wouldn't have had Star Wars, Star Trek.
I see.
We wouldn't have what we have now by any stretch of the imagination. Might have had sci-fi was where you went to make your hippie, crazy, trippy movies. That might have been its
right. That's true.
This film belongs in the fanfic world or in a comic adaptation. And I don't even want to say that because that sounds like it insults comic book adaptations. But even as a comic book adaptation, it would have needed a story edit. This was just something that is in a fanfic world or the underground world, and it's. There's a reason the guy doesn't make, he's not a filmmaker. He's not. He can say he is, but there's a reason that he's not actually working in the industry since 1990. And has done one thing. Aside from the fact that he's a monster. But allegedly.
You know, I can say this too. One of the reasons I'm glad it didn't come out. One is because of that cult-like spiritual thing. That really sticks me in the worst way. But also, he's an egomaniac. He really is.
Oh, you can see that instantly. Like, he thinks he's something. Yeah, he thinks he's one of the names in film.
And that would have come out in his work. That, because people that are egomaniacs like that think they can fart on a plate and show it to you and say, see, you can see my fart and now whip it for the enlightenment.
He keeps putting himself in the lead role in his films. Who does that?
He's a complete egomaniac that would have shown in his work. I happen to agree with Tim Kask, whom we interviewed years ago, one of the guys that was at TSR at the beginning with D&D, and said, if we had been thinking that we were making legends out of our work, it would have shown in our work and we would have done a bad job. And people would not have appreciated what we did. He said, at the time, it was our biggest advantage that we were just having fun with it, running a decent business and just happy as God that the checks cleared and having fun. He's like, that allowed us to do our best work. This guy thinks he's God's gift to the world. And I mean, it's already come out. He's already made video. He did an interview with IndieWire where he was dumping on Denis Villeneuve's upcoming Dune, saying how, oh, it's going to be predictable. Well, of course it can be predictable by your standards, because look what you wrote. You wrote Paul dying and becoming some kind of global conscious, turning Dune into a jungle and traveling around the world seeding planets.
It's an adaptation of a novel.
Huh?
It's an adaptation of a novel. It's supposed to be predictable. It's not supposed to be unpredictable. I'm not supposed to go watch Dune and go, holy crap, I didn't see that coming. Did you see that Paul would kill the Lady Jessica and then embrace his Harkonnen lineage?
It's the Rian Johnson effect that I want to subvert what everyone says. I am so desperate to not be predictable and to make sure half the audience hates me that I'm going to do something so horrible and off kilter. But, and that's why I also say, so wait, you thought that that was a good way to get money? Okay. Yeah. You know what you're doing, Kennedy. Got it. But, and that's the same thing here. He has no right to criticize Denis for making a bad movie. And also, too, he's like, it's going to be big budget. Oh, that's rich coming from the guy who wanted to pay Salvador Dali $100,000 in a minute because he's the only one who can play the Emperor. That's rich coming from a guy that wanted tons of money, like $15 million, which was a ton at that time. Just because a movie takes a lot of money doesn't make it bad.
No. And it's pretty ridiculous to criticize Denis before you've seen the movie for making a bad movie.
Right.
Can we see the movie first?
Well, I mean, you can predict certain elements, but from what little we have seen, it's like, all right, that looks like it could be a good adaptation, better than David Lynch's. So, it certainly looks better than the sci-fi series, but the sci-fi series had its budget limitations, but it made up for it by nailing the story and having good actors. Whereas Jodorowsky, I don't even know what they were. I'm glad it didn't get made. It would have set sci-fi back. It would have set Dune back. It would have made that guy feel like he wasn't even, it would have fed his ego and his cult-like status. For all I know, he would have gone on to make a new religion called Scientology 2.
Well, you know, we've discussed at length this month with Dune that it's a tough franchise to bring to the screen. And it needs an experienced hand to be able to look at it and almost take a Hemingway effect to it, where you say, is this needed, and keep pruning until you have eliminated what you don't need, because there's so much source material there. And there were so many things that, to be quite honest, Frank Herbert never fully clarified in his six novels. So it needs a very experienced director and it needs a very experienced script writer. And I don't think that that his team of spiritual warriors really filled that bill. The best person that he got was Mobius. And that's not a guy who's making films. That's a guy who's drawing. And he's very talented. But ultimately, I don't think you had the people running this project, involved in it at the highest levels, to take something as complex as Dune, with all of the topics that it has to hit on, and the storyline of intrigue and bureaucratic manipulation at the expense of not having action. The easiest way to drive a plot is to have action drive it, and conflict resolution with a big action fight and to hack and slash. If you were, you know, running a game, hack and slash is the easiest way to write an adventure or to write a story. Dune is not something you can hack and slash. It's deep. You got to play the subtext. You got to write with the subtext. And I don't think you had the crew to do that. You need someone who's very pragmatic. You need someone who's very focused, and you need someone who can figure out how to go from A to B to C to D and stay on track from A to B to C to D. And that wasn't Jodorowsky. And I don't think it was anyone in that staff. And I think ultimately all the problems with bringing Dune to the screen would have been made manifest and multiplied over and over and over. And what would have came out was a massive disaster. And while I was intrigued, honestly, in the first part of this documentary, I agree with Thomas that about halfway through, I looked at it and said, this would have been a nightmare of epic proportions had they gone ahead and made this film.
Right. I think that about sums it.
I was about to say, we can't exactly rate it this week, but I think our agreed decision is We're glad it wasn't made, and it would have been a disaster if it was.
Yeah, that you're right. We couldn't rate it, so that's why I kind of ended it with, would you have wanted it made? And I'm, yeah, we've all kind of reached the same conclusion. No, thank God, Jodorowsky, move on, and let Denis try it.
Yep.
So, okay, so, Sickies, if you want to learn more about that in a little bit more detail, you can watch the documentary. It's on Amazon Prime, or you could just go buy it, I guess, if you want the physical copy.
Yeah, that makes Jodorowsky money. I just don't.
We already made him money by watching the documentary.
Yeah, but we don't have to tell other people to give him money.
Yeah, we explained it well enough, I think.
All right, that's a point. If you want, you could try to watch a few clips on YouTube. Hopefully he didn't monetize that. And if he did, then don't. But at any rate, so next week, so we're going to be having our end of the year wrap up, where we'll be doing our bits and pieces, and where we just kind of pick apart what we like the best about our podcast in 2020. The podcast, let me stress that. And then we'll move on next month to trekking into the new year. So I would like to say from all of us here at Sci-Fi Malady, as we're getting into the holiday seasons, have a Merry Christmas. And if you don't do Christmas, whatever happy holiday you're doing, hopefully you stay safe and can see some family.
Absolutely. And, you know, we'll skip all the commentary stuff this week. Just what's left for them to do, Rage Master?
Stay stick, Sickies.